think that, you know, the fire that was ignited last year that has moved us all into action, you know, clearly, I think, is in this audience today, and I'm sure across the country. So we are really lucky and honored to be joined by Mike Brown today, who will be discussing the movement of Black Lives Matter, but also how we can achieve Black liberation. So Mike Brown is an independent socialist based in Long Beach, California. He's been engaged in activism and organizing for a decade now. Brown is a co-founder of a Black Lives Matter chapter in Long Beach, along with being a co-founder of the Long Beach May Day Coalition. As a revolutionary socialist and activist, Brown has taken part in struggles against police terror in Southern California, solidarity work alongside both Teamster truckers and warehouse workers at the ports of LA and Long Beach. And I think it's only right to welcome Mike Brown, I think, with a chant. So let's give it up. Black Lives Matter! 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 All right, everyone, give it up for Mike Brown.
Wow. Now, what an introduction. I hope my audio is good. Is everybody good with my audio? Thumbs up. Give me a thumbs up. Okay, that's what's up. Like to hear that. But yeah, wow. Great introduction there. Just starting off, just to get the house cleaning out of the way. First things first, I want to thank Socialist Alternative for inviting me to yet another one of their events, another one of their forums. I feel like since the George Floyd rebellion last summer, you know, I've been in numerous meetings with you all, big and small, and it's always been a pleasure, not only to speak, but to just sit and learn and to get that real internationalist perspective. And then I want to thank Naui for moderating this as well. That's not an easy job. Thanks for that introduction. That got me pumped up, ready to go. And then I also want to extend my solidarity definitely to the Aboriginal community there in Australia. You know, as an activist, ever since I've been studying these ideas and theories, you know, I've always, you know, tried to place the most oppressed at the center of struggle. So we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. I'm not going to talk or give an exhaustive, like overall talk tonight. You know, I'm going to try to go maybe 20, 25 minutes because I really want to get to the Q&A. And I also want to hear, you know, what's the Australian perspective on this? Because, you know, truth be told, y'all were in the streets too. I was following all your publications and all of your radical outlets out there. And y'all were in the streets, you know, big time last summer as well, you know, in solidarity with us. So, and, you know, it's all up. So I want to hear, you know, some of what's going on over there and some of the fights that y'all are having against police terrorism currently and imperialism and all these other ideas. So, yeah, you know, we can jump right into the talk here. What I'm going to try to do today, like I said, it's just going to be maybe a series of snapshots. I'm not going to try to get too in-depth on every topic, because that will be here all night. But, you know, Marxism and Black liberation, I mean, that's at the center of the political project that I'm trying to carry out or be a part of, you know, in this country and also just internationally. So, you know, what I'm going to do tonight is, you know, I want to get into the foundations of, you know, what is Marxism? What is Black liberation? We're going to talk about the Black radical tradition and the historic role that's played in this country. We're going to talk about, you know, how those ideas have found themselves infused in labor struggles, civil rights struggles, anti-lynching struggles, and, you know, the contemporary struggles with the union drive down in Bessemer, Alabama, where 85% of the workers are Black, and also the Black Lives Matter movement, which is at a pivotal moment right now. You know, it's being pulled from, you know, both sides in terms of reformism and revolution. So there's a lot of, you know, interesting dynamics at play. That, you know, the corporate press doesn't necessarily follow. But, you know, those of us who are on the ground and know some of the people who are really involved, you know, we could bring a different perspective. So first things first, I just want to, you know, just for those who may be uninitiated or maybe not know what these, you know, ideas are, I want to start off, you know, defining Marxism. It's a big part of, you know, my political project. It's how it's a lens that I look at the world through. So I think it's important to always understand that, you know, it's just a framework. It's a lens to look at this world, to interpret it, to understand it, and then to try to change the world. It informs, you know, how we organize and the type of organizations that we put together. I think, you know, in terms of the ABCs of Marxism, you know, put simply, I try to, you know, make it as uncomplicated as possible. And one of the things I really appreciate about Marxism that I didn't get, you know, in other, you know, lenses of politics that I, you know, pursued was, you know, it talks about the fundamental division of society, you know, which is a ruling class and a working class, you know, the ruling class being a small group that owns all the means of production. And then the working class, which is the, you know, the vast majority of society that has to sell its labor to, you know, subsist from day to day. And that dynamic, you know, exists all across this planet. We're seeing it play out in places like Myanmar, where they've had massive general strikes. We've seen it play out, you know, recently in France, you know, the Yellow Vest movement. And all throughout South America, where people are fighting against austerity, which, you know, which is basically a clash of workers versus, you know, rulers. The rulers are trying to pawn off their debts on us. And, you know, despite the fact that we create all the labor in society. So I think that's important. In terms of Marxism as well, you know, I think Marxism is important because it talks about, you know, the role of the state. The state is not neutral in any of these instances, in any of these struggles, whether it be, you know, you opposing war or being against police brutality or labor exploitation. The state is set up to protect the prerogatives and the for-profit interests, you know, of that small ruling clique, that small ruling minority. I think Marxism is important as well, and you know, and a good framework for us to use because it talks about the fact that, you know, the interests of the working class versus the ruling class, they're diametrically opposed. There's no types of you know, reforms that can fundamentally smooth that over. The interest of the ruling class is to, you know, maximize profits at our expense, at the expense of the environment, at the expense of the world and all living life. And, you know, our interest is to, you know, try to live the best life possible. But those two things don't always merge together. When you have a real rapacious kind of for-profit system that subjugates everything else, you know, as to secondary status. So, and then I want to skip and talk about Black liberation and what that is, because that can mean many different things to a lot of different people. You know, just to let people know, you know, before I came into Marxism, you know, I was running into some of the Black nationalist circles here in America. I was just looking for answers. I knew I wasn't satisfied with what was going on, but none of them had this analysis of Marxism. But in terms of just Black liberation, I just define it, you know, very kind of shortly as, you know, self-determination. Ever since Black people have gotten here in America, you know, just in the U.S. context, you know, we've been subjugated, you know, from our physical well-being to our, you know, economics to where we could live to every aspect of our social and economic lives. They've always been, you know, at the whim of this white supremacist and capitalist system. So I think Black liberation would free us from that. And I like to call it working class Black liberation because, you know, we have to understand that, you know, we have internal rivalries and also internal class divisions as well. And I'm going to talk about that, you know, at the end. But I think it's best encapsulated by this great quote by Stokely Carmichael that I really like. And I'm going to, you know, kind of go into it. I'm not going to go too heavy with quotes tonight, but his quote reads, you know, talking about Black self-determination. If a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If a white man has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. And what he's talking about there is, you know, if you're self-determined and if you're autonomous and if you have the organization and the power to resist a man lynching you, you know, you're good to go. And you can sub out, you know, lynch with redlining or mass incarceration or police brutality or a number of the other ills that, you know, are afflicted upon us. But that's basically what he was getting at. He was talking about, you know, self-determination with that quote. And I think that's something that we need to hold close to vest because, you know, what kind of social power do we have to build or what's going to be required for us to build so that we can then resist, you know, any of these types of oppressions that come our way. I think Stokely Carmichael hit on a great point there. He also talked about the fact that racism gets its power from capitalism, which, you know, we'll talk about, you know, as the night goes on as well. Talks about the fact that the two, you know, are kind of corollaries of each other. They feed each other. So speaking of the black radical tradition, you know, I think Stokely Carmichael is a great place to start at, because, you know, I like to highlight different names, you know, from the black radical tradition, whose politics and theories were informed by Marxism, because I don't know about internationally, but over here in America, particularly since the 60s, when, you know, the black radical movements were defeated by COINTELPRO and wiped out and co-opted, people tend to think that, you know, Marxism is kind of a quote unquote white thing or too Eurocentric or something like that. So I always like to push back and, you know, talk about, you know, the pantheon of great black radicals that we've had, you know, not only here in America, but throughout the diaspora. I think it's important to talk about people like C.L.R. James, you know, who was a great Marxist, Fred Hampton, you know, whose name has been in the news here of late, you know, since the recent release of the Judas and the Black Messiah movie, although they didn't really, you know, center his politics. But Hubert Harrison, you know, figures like him, you know, Harry Haywood, Ella Baker, W.B. Du Bois, Huey P. Newton, all of these black folks, Walter Rodney, you know, Thomas Sankara, Amilcar Cabral, these are people from overseas in Africa who were revolutionary Pan-Africanists, but they were also Marxists. So I think it's important, you know, for us to take ownership of these ideas and understand that this is our tradition, too. It's not just a quote unquote white thing. Groups from the past, such as the Black Panther Party, the Combahee River Collective, the Revolutionary Action Movement, the League of Black Work, Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, all of these different, you know, formations were, informed by Marxist politics of some variant, whether it was Marxism or Leninism or even some types of Maoism as well. So, again, you know, you can't separate black struggle from radical politics in this country. Contemporary figures that exist right now, people like, you know, Dr. Joy James and, you know, Assata Shakur, who's still alive over there and has asylum in Cuba, you know, Angela Davis, Ajamu Baraka, and then groups like the Black Alliance for Peace and the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Even though some of these formations are very small currently, they represent, you know, a germ of what used to be, which is, you know, black radical explicit organizing and politics that can make some sense of the world. So just to give folks a quick anecdote about myself, just in terms of how I came to these ideas, because it wasn't a given. I'm from an apolitical family. I didn't grow up with this stuff. I didn't read a lick of Marxism until I was, you know, about 30, you know, about 10 years ago when I started all this down this journey. But yeah, just, you know, I was a pissed off Obama voter like everybody else in 2008, or like a lot of people. A lot of people still stand in Obama, but I wasn't one of them. I think in about 2009, I was like, okay, I'm jumping off this bandwagon. So then, you know, I was a labor reporter and also a sports writer for a local black newspaper. And I found myself at a rally, a labor rally that I was covering, which was, it was in solidarity with the occupation going on in Wisconsin. I think that was 2011 or something, 2010. But yeah, I ran into like a couple of socialist groups, and you know, they had a bunch of books on Malcolm X. I was already into Malcolm, you know, even though I didn't know what socialism or Marxism really was. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go to these meetings. You know, they were meeting at USC. I'm here in LA. Our newspaper office wasn't far from their places. So I found myself going to their meetings and picking up their books. And, you know, one day I just bought the Rosa Luxemburg Reform or Revolution. And, you know, I ain't looked back since. It's been on ever since then. So, you know, that's pretty much, you know, the beginnings of my development and becoming a, you know, a revolutionary Marxist. You know, and saying that, you know, again, you know, I want to stress that Marxism is just a framework. And, you know, when you look at black struggle historically, it's been there since the beginning. Even if our people weren't necessarily conscious Marxists or whatever, you know, Marxists were either paying attention to our struggles or, you know, they were passing off some of the ideas in them. So I want to talk about, you know, black struggle. I want to talk about actually slavery, political economy, and race. So let's start with slavery. So for, you know, more than 250 years in this country, you know, they had what they called the quote unquote peculiar institution, which was chattel slavery. Now, anybody who knows anything about slavery in this country, it was a very, you know, violent institution. It's the only way that they can maintain it. It was one of the most hyper exploitative institutions in the history of humankind. You know, we labored in this country for almost over 250 years for free. I mean, that's unheard of right there. No, you know, we're not even talking about the Middle Passage and the brutality of that. And then just in terms of the political economy of it, you know, racism, I'm not racism, but slavery was big business. I mean, it was one of the first big international trades in this world. It was a trading and a shipping of human beings all across the globe to be sold and bartered and you know, ultimately abused, you know, until they dropped dead. You know, people, these capitalists, they exploited and extracted all kinds of profits out of them. And then just in terms of race, you know, I think race is important in terms of understanding, you know, what the origins of it are. One thing I like about Marxism is it's a social, economic, and a political science, you know, emphasis on the word science. And, you know, while racism is a very real thing and white supremacy are very real things, race is a social construct. There is no such thing biologically as race or physiologically as race. So it's important to understand, you know, why it came to be the way it came to be in this country. And, you know, it came to be because it served a very important ideological service in service of, you know, those who rule the society, because they need, you know, racism and they need all these divisions to keep the working class apart. But at that time, you know, they needed it to justify, you know, the fact that they were enslaving people and treating them, you know, extremely brutally and savagely, as far as I see it. In terms of just chattel slavery, you know, it was something that was going on for 250 years, but it wasn't off the radar of people internationally. You had, you know, very early on, you had abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, who was going over to England and places like that and talking about, you know, abolitionism and talking about the horrors of slavery. And, you know, that caught the attention of, you know, then, you know, Marx. You know, I think this is before he even wrote the Communist Manifesto, where he was talking about, you know, how, you know, slavery and came to be, you know. He talked about the fact, I like this quote that he used in Das Kapital, where he says, if money comes into the world with a congenital blood stain on one cheek, capital comes dripping from head to toe from every pore with blood and dirt. And what he's talking about there is, you know, primitive accumulation. The fact that slavery didn't come to be because it was just natural. It came through, you know, land theft, war, colonialism, enslavement. That's how these people were able to build up the wealth that they built up through primitive accumulation. And slavery was a real central part of that. Barbara Fields and Karen Fields, you know, who were part of the Combahee River Collective, a group that I mentioned a minute ago, they talked about the financial underpinnings of slavery, where they, you know, said very simply in their book, Racecraft, you know, slavery wasn't about producing, quote unquote, white supremacy. It was about producing, you know, cotton, you know, other things from the ground, you know, spices. That's how they made money. They couldn't make money off of white supremacy. They made money off of what the slaves' stolen labor was able to produce. And then when you talk about Marx again, you know, in relation to slavery, you know, Marx openly talked about the fact that, you know, labor in the white skin couldn't emancipate itself as long as labor in black skin was, you know, branded, wasn't emancipated. I mean, he talked about that contradiction back in, what, the 1850s, 1860s. You know, so he was way ahead of the game. So that's something that really stood out to me when I was reading, you know, Das Kapital and some of the Marxist classics. I was like, okay, he was on this quick. He was on this real early. And then when you talk about Marxism in that era again, you know, you got to talk about the sociologist, the Marxist sociologist, W.E.B. Du Bois, in his book, Black Reconstruction, where he talked about the fact that the slaves, you know, they staged the first general strike in the history of this country, when you really look at it. when the Union troops were descending on the South, the back of the South was broken in part by the fact that, you know, there were mass defections from the plantations. People were participating in sabotage. Slaves were killing their masters. They were conducting espionage. They basically undermined the South. They helped, you know, in addition to the black soldiers who then took up arms for the Union. So, yeah, very early on, you see Marxists, you know, black and white, you know, they had opinions on these things. So I think that's a real key kind of pillar of, you know, when you start talking about, you know, the infusion of Marxism into black struggle. And then we see a lot of that happen into the next century, particularly with labor. I'm not going to try to get into all the names of the black radicals that were involved in these different struggles, but just in labor, I always want to, you know, key in on that, because that's where our greatest social power as a working class comes from, you know, our collective ability to withhold or shut down labor. And black radical organization has always been at the center of that. From the, you know, Knights of Labor, which was founded in 1869, that was like one of the first interracial labor federations in this country. I think it was the first one that admitted blacks. Remember, we were only 4 years out of bondage, but black people, you know, who were skilled tradesmen in the South, you know, they were joining in mass. They were like, okay, yeah, we want to get unionized. We want to, you know, participate in organized labor struggles. Earlier in the, you know, in the 20th century, you get a guy like A. Philip Randolph. You know, he founds the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which is, you know, unprecedented in the 1920s. That's the first black-led labor organization. In the 1930s, you have the communists, black communists, organizing alongside white communists in the sharecroppers unions down in Alabama. You got black people infused in labor organizing in the Congress of Industrial Organizations. That's the CIO before it merged with the AFL. And then later on, you have the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which is in Detroit, where their politics are explicitly informed by, you know, a mix of black nationalism, Marxism, and Leninism. And then later on, you have, you know, a radical local like Oakland IOWU Local 10, which in the 1980s was at the tip of the spear of the anti-apartheid movement in this country. In fact, they, you know, refused to load ships that were, you know, sending supplies over to South Africa. They were in solidarity with the Sandinistas and the FMLN down in Nicaragua and El Salvador, respectively. They didn't load ships for them. And, you know, even in contemporary times, I think last year during, Juneteenth, they staged a one-day strike in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement at the ports of Oakland. So unfortunately, we don't have many of those contemporary examples, but those are just a snapshot from the past. In terms of just other struggles that existed throughout that century, I mean, you can see black radicalism infused all through the defeats of Jim Crow and also anti-lynching movements. And a lot of the theoretical framework of those movements was laid in part, you know, by radical publications that were headed over by, you know, open Marxists, open socialists. You talk about the Harlem Renaissance, so you got to start talking about, you know, magazines like The Messenger. That was founded by A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen, two black socialists. They were talking about, you know, black people not just getting lynched, you know, shoot back, fight back, black labor organizing. They were talking about the Russian Revolution. You had The Crisis, a magazine presided over by W.E.B. Du Bois, who, you know, was given a lot of space to black radicals. Even by that time, you know, he was still kind of considered a moderate in late teens and early 1920s. But yeah, he was talking about, you know, CIO organizing in his pages, and he was talking about what was going on in Haiti with the American occupation. Another magazine, you know, co-founded by Langston Hughes, a name that many of you may be familiar with, who had a lot of dealings, like a lot of the Harlem Renaissance writers, like Ralph Ellison and many others, you know, with the Communist Party. He had a magazine called Fire, where they were talking about black resistance, you know, not only up north, but also down south. And then you had that followed up by groups like, you know, the African Blood Brotherhood. That was an explicitly socialist communist group, where even some of the members, like Claude McKay, they went over at the behest of some of the Bolsheviks in Russia. They went to, I think, the Second International or the Third one. I might be getting those mixed up. But yeah, so again, I'm just saying that to point out that, you know, Black liberation and Black Marxism has always, you know, not only had an international bent, but it's always been there with us through all of our struggles. Even overseas, you know, revolutionaries like, you know, Vladimir Lenin and also Trotsky, they wrote explicitly about what they called, you know, the Black question. So they saw the centrality of Black struggle in this country. So, you know, again, you're starting to see a corollary between revolutionaries at home and also abroad. They're like, oh, okay, these guys are on to something. So we need to be pushing this. I know I'm getting a warning there by the mods, but I needed a little bit of an extension. So let's extend it 5 more minutes. Hopefully that's cool. Good looking out. And then also another statement I thought that was important. I really want to get this in and highlight it. So the We Declare Genocide statement, which I believe was important because one of the ways that Jim Crow was defeated in this country is the fact that, you know, Black radicals and Black organizers played the United States off of, you know, what they called the quote unquote the third world or the communist bloc. But frankly, they embarrassed America. That's one of the reasons why, you know, de jure Jim Crow apartheid was, you know, eventually defeated in sections of the ruling class in this country. They decided to give it up because it just didn't make America look good overseas. But the We Declare Genocide statement, that was written by Black communists. W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, people like Claudia Jones. Who else am I missing? Ferdinand Smith, he was a labor organizer. So you had these folks at the middle of these struggles, you know, writing these incredible statements. Paul Robeson was in there too. So I want to briefly kind of get to the conclusion here, because like I said, we can talk all night. I can pack a lot into this, but I want to talk about why does this all matter? So I think there's a dialectical relationship between Marxism and Black liberation. As Malcolm X said, I love the quote from earlier that the moderator shared, but he also said, you know, you show me a capitalist, I'll show you a bloodsucker. And I think that's key. And Malcolm wasn't even a Marxist, and that's okay. But, you know, the fact that he understood that, I was like, oh, okay, he's on to something. So, yeah, I was just, you know, that's something I take a lot of inspiration from. And he was absolutely right, you know, so because one feeds the other. And so he talks about, you know, the corollary between, you know, race and exploitation. Also, I think these ideas are important because there's a Black bourgeoisie in this country that's pretty destructive. They're in all the halls of power. They don't have our interests at heart. So we have to have some type of a framework to understand that we got to resist them too, along with the larger system. And then just in terms of today's movements, I'm trying to move this along quickly. The BLM movement, it needs these ideas, you know, especially right now, because like I said, there's some frictions in the movement between, you know, those who want to orient around more moderate ideas and electoral ideas. And then there's other ones who are just saying, hey, we got to tear the whole thing down. So I think these ideas and these theories could really help sharpen the arguments of those of us, you know, who are not reformists. And also we need to talk about what kind of organization that we need, because it's one thing to yell all these demands, but, you know, how are you going to go about winning them? How are you going to go about achieving them? That's a big question right there. So, and then also the union drive down in Bessemer, Alabama. So we've been talking about that a lot. So that involves mostly Black workers. It's like 85% of the workforce is Black. So if you know anything about Alabama, it's got like a real rich history of not only labor organizing, but also civil rights struggle. So these are key questions that they can use as well, because, you know, for as great as that campaign is, it's pretty top down. And there's some, you know, confusion around the Democratic Party and its role that it's playing there. So I'm going to stop there. I don't want to go too long. I want to hear everybody else's questions and input, but I got plenty more, so we can get into that in the discussion. But thanks, and I'll stop there. So great. Thanks again to the moderator. Really appreciate that. Thanks again to everybody who attended this. We probably can't get to all the questions, but I'll try to touch on a lot of them briefly. just real quick, just off top, because I kind of gave Bessemer a short shrift just to give people some more context. So not only is the majority of the workforce Black, but Amazon is not unionized in this country at all. So this will be the first warehouse that will be unionized. So it would set some really important precedent. And also being in the South, that's a right to work state. I don't know if people are familiar with that term there, but basically it's an anti-union law. So it would be a big boom for not only that region, but for the labor movement overall. And many of the people who are organizing there, not only did they take part in the marches last summer, but these are the people who are also fighting against the Confederate flag in Alabama over the past few years. So many of them were also workers at the local poultry plants, which are unionized. So these are people who are, a lot of them are real, you know, battle tested. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Just real quick on some of the questions. Let me see where I have them written down. Kind of lost my place. Oh, well, the first one, just talking about just any the chance of any other struggles happening. You know, right now on the horizon, I got to be honest, I don't really see anything else kindling up. The teachers were making some noise in some of the different cities a few months ago, but unfortunately, they've fallen in line behind, you know, the AFT and also all these other unions who are around the Democrats. So they're going to open up. We're basically about to open the country back up regardless. So that's happening. Only other struggles that I kind of see are watch the mine workers down there in Alabama. They just announced a strike. So that's happening. It's 1,100 of them. I forgot what city they're in, but they're not far from Bessemer. So maybe there can be some collaboration between them and the warehouse workers. So look for that. Things are quiet on the front here in California. In terms of some of the other questions, just in terms of BLM, just, you know, I think it's important to understand for folks, especially overseas, there is like a distinction to make between BLM, the organization, which is a formal org. It's more structured, and then there's BLM, the kind of wider movement. That's what you saw in the streets last summer. Most of those people, the 15 to 25 estimated million people that were out there, were not formally organized. It was a lot of new people. It was their first time at protests. So BLM, the organization, really had nothing to do with what you saw last summer in most of the cities. A lot of those were spontaneous actions. And that's why they kind of took on the character they did, you know, which is very insurrectionary. BLM, Global Network, there's been a lot of controversy around them lately because they got, you know, $90 million reportedly last year. So it's a lot of infighting over that. I'm sure y'all have seen some of that drama play out on social media. It's kind of messy. It's too much to get into. I won't get into it, but it's interesting. It's all over social media. But, you know, at the heart of that is really political differences that some of you have brought up in the comments. So, you know, just keep checking around. Check around hashtag BLM 10. Those are the ones who are demanding, you know, transparency around the money. Those folks are more to the left than the BLM Global Network, which is, you know, basically an appendage of the Democratic Party at this point. So be on the lookout for that. Let me see what the other questions are, if I can find them. Okay, sorry, y'all, I can't find them. So I'm gonna wrap it there. But thanks so much. Glad you had me.
Thanks so much for that, Mike. That was really incredible, and what a history that is so rich, actually, around Black liberation and socialism. So thank you so much for joining us. I believe that we will be de-linking now, and just here to stay with me for a few announcements.